Welcome to the Beloved Community, resources for activism. My name is John Shuck. On the Beloved Community, you hear interviews with scholars, activists, authors, and artists who are making a difference in regards to social justice and human flourishing. The Beloved Community is heard on the second Friday of each month at 9 a.m. on KBOO. I also host a weekly radio show and podcast called Progressive Spirit. The website for information and links to podcasts is progressivespirit.net. Today on the Beloved Community, I have two guests, Dinah Ramey Berry and Caverly Morgan. Dinah Ramey Berry is an associate professor of history in African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved, From Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation.
Even in the newspapers, they'll have columns where they'll talk about how to grow a Negro. Literally, that's the term, like, you know, how on raising Negroes and livestock. And they literally manage this system of reproduction very similar to animal husbandry.
Dr. Berry will be up in the second half hour. My first guest is Caverly Morgan, the founding director of Peace in Schools.
If we had mindfulness in high schools everywhere, or even earlier, we could solve huge amounts of problems. I mean, society, as we say today, is kind of like a battleground almost. Somebody says something, somebody doesn't like that, has to retaliate. But if we had mindfulness, we can learn to accept that my reality is different from yours, and your reality is different than mine. And you're entitled to think your opinion, and I'm entitled to think my opinion. And if we can just accept the fact that I know that you think differently than I do, but I'm willing to accept that, and I'm willing to accept to be your friend, we could solve infinite number of issues.
Giving everything unconditional love, including myself, it kind of just like, it's really hard. Like, it's really hard to like love things when like you're in a really bad like place sometimes, or when you're in a really bad mood. But like, it just feels so much better like loving things. Like, it's so much harder to be angry or to be sad, and it's hard to be happy, but it's so much like better, and it's healthier, and it's just like, I strive for happiness and I strive for greatness, and this class has helped me doing that. Like, it's helped me like learn new coping mechanisms, and like when like something's happening, to just like breathe and realize that it's gonna be okay.
And I know so many of my peers just struggle with depression and anxiety and anger and just all of these deeply felt emotions, and they're not given an outlet of how to deal with them and be with them. Instead, they're just taught to ignore them and just put on a happy face. I was in a dark place coming into this class, didn't think that like I was ever gonna get out of it, but I truly believe that this class has saved my life.
Those are testimonies from students at various Portland high schools. They've participated in the Peace in Schools program. In 2014, Peace in Schools launched the first 4-credit high school mindfulness course in the nation, and that's right here in Portland. Caverly Morgan is the founding director of Peace in Schools. She leads the Peace in Schools teaching team, develops mindfulness curricula, and works directly with teens. Welcome, Caverly, to the Beloved Community.
I'm so glad to be here.
Let's kind of just do a 101, if that's okay.
Of course.
You've been practicing mindfulness since 1995. What is mindfulness, and how did you get started practicing mindfulness?
I wasn't looking for it. I actually found mindfulness because I stumbled upon it. And the way we define it through Peace in Schools is being here and now with kindness. So we like to keep it simple when we're speaking with the teens. And the more that I work with adults, the more I realize it can be helpful to keep it simple with us as well. So I stumbled upon a practice of how to train my attention to be in the present moment without judgment, you know, employing curiosity about the nature of my present moment experience.
So being present in the moment with kindness.
Yeah, being here and now with kindness.
Tell us a little bit about this program, Peace in Schools,
sure.
And how you got it going and what it does.
Well, it's funny. We stumbled upon the name again. I feel like on one level it happened accidentally, and on another level it feels like some sort of divine intervention. But this name, Peace in Schools, really encapsulates it. You know, we're offering mindfulness practice, but the program is a lot more. There's a lot more to the program than simply assisting children in training the attention to be in the present moment without judgment. We're creating an experience that is reflective of that which is most real in this world. And there's little reflection within high school walls of that which is most real. So students in our classes are not just learning how to train the attention to be present, but they're learning how to get in touch with their heart, an experience of love, an experience of connectivity, you know, how to relate to other people in a way that isn't contaminated with all of the dramas, the conditioned dramas that are so familiar to us, especially during that time. You know, we're adopting such deep beliefs about how the world works, who we should be, how we should survive our lives. And in our course, we get the chance to unpack that, not through asking teens to take on a new belief system, but through bringing the mind of inquiry to the belief systems that they're currently downloading.
So talk about, if you wouldn't mind, what the course is like. What will the, mm-hmm. What do the teenagers do?
Each class, I get to see teens for over 75 hours in a semester. And, you know, that's more than I see most adults. So that's 90 minutes a class, two times a week or three times a week, depending on that Portland Public School schedule. And each class starts with mindful movement. Okay. So we're inviting teens to bring the attention into the body. And that's really important. You can imagine as a teenager coming into a room and having someone ask you to do some kind of contemplative exercise and then maybe meditate for 3 minutes. You know, if you've been sitting still in a desk all day, that's going to be a tall order. So it's, I think, worked quite well to have the class begin with some kind of movement practice that brings the attention into the body. So it not only can strengthen the body, stretch the body, open the body, it can create a deeper level of awareness of ourselves in the body, which, as you might also remember as an awkward teenager, you know, our relationship with our bodies is kind of funky, you know, like
a lot of shame.
There's shame. There's embarrassment. Yeah. I mean, I remember going through puberty and just not knowing what to do with mm-hmm. that experience and how my body was changing and how it was changing so quickly. So it's an important part of the class to begin with mindful movement. And then we move into the mindfulness lesson of the day. And that can be anywhere from a basic mindfulness exercise that anyone doing a mindfulness practice might imagine, for example, mindful eating or mindful walking. Or, you know, once we've really moved through the basics, the foundational elements of a mindfulness practice, we might move into exploring our negative self-talk. You know, what is it that as we're moving throughout the day, we say to ourselves unconsciously about the world, about other people, and about ourselves?
Self-talk. On the website, peaceinschools.org, you have a number of testimonies, video testimonies of some of the students, and they're very excited about the program. And a lot of that has to do with how they see themselves and others. Mm-hmm. The stories, the tapes, I guess we play among our heads. And so, the mindfulness training is to be awake to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Not necessarily judge it, but to know that it exists.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important clarifier. Not to judge it at all. You know, not to just become present to that internal critic and then bring more judgment to the experience mm-hmm. that, oh my gosh, now I have this internal critic. I'm such a loser. But to really, through the lens of compassion, get to see for the first time what internal landscape we're living in and creating through thought form. What are we maintaining?
Yeah. Now, is there dialogue within this? So is this an opportunity for students to speak back what they're experiencing?
And thank you. I actually really appreciate that you brought that up, because I forget that if I don't mention that, people might think that a lot of the class is in silence, and it's actually not. The class is deeply engaged on the level of mindful relating. So one of the special things that happens in the class is teens get an experience to really become intimate with each other in a very appropriate way, of course, within a high school setting. That word can be a little bit charged sometime. But what I mean by that word is that teens who normally would see themselves as separate from each other, that falls away within the context of this class. So the popular high school cheerleader is in the same class that the girl who's too afraid to speak up in settings outside her home, like truly real displays of social anxiety. Not only are they in the same room, they're in the same room learning how much they have in common. So we might do a self-talk exercise, for example, that allows that student who's been afraid to speak to see that that popular high school girl has the exact same negative self-talk that she does, that she's feeling victimized by that same internal voice that says, you don't know what you're doing, no one likes you, why are you wearing that today, you're getting fat. You know, those are the same conversations for two people who otherwise would see themselves to be existing on different planets.
Kaverly Morgan is my guest. She is the founding director of Peace in Schools, and the Portland is the first place in the country that has had 4-credit classes on mindfulness. Talk about a little bit the pragmatics of getting that to happen.
Well, I will give some acknowledgement here to a principal named Brian Chittard, who still is at Wilson High School.
That's where it started. That was the first high school.
The first high school we began was Wilson High School. And I give him credit because, you know, it's one thing for someone who used to be a monastic to recognize a possibility regarding bringing practice to teens. It's another for a principal to say, I see what's possible here, and I'd like to follow that thread, especially when it's never been done before. So Brian observed an after-school class that I was offering on a volunteer basis with a friend named Allison Copacino, who was bringing in the movement portion of the class. He observed us teaching at Wilson High School, and he said to me after one of the classes, the skills you're bringing these students need to be reaching more of my students. You only have like 8 kids in this little volunteer after school program, but I have a real mental health crisis happening in my school. There had been suicides in the school. Each counselor could have between 200 and 300 teens in their caseload, and there's no way they could be tracking their mental well-being. And he acknowledged there were no tools of wellness, of supporting mental and emotional health in the school in the form of a class. So he said, I really want you to be reaching more of my teens. And I think at the time his idea was, how can we get more teens to come to your after school class? I said to him, I really believe the only way we'll reach more teens is if we make this a class that's during the school day, which was a big request for many reasons, including I was not a certified and licensed Portland Public School teacher. But because my friend Allison was, we decided, or Brian really decided, that if we did demos and we got 20, 25 teens saying, yes, we'd like to take this class, that he would, because of Allison's license, have the ability to put us for a section in maybe in the health department or something, just one class. Well, over 300 teens said they wanted the course after we did 2 days of demos. And so he called and he wanted to hire us full time. And I said, I'm definitely not ready to be a full time high school teacher. And I think we're on to something. And we most definitely were. Our program bred very organically from there. The class was a huge success. And then another high school saw the success of the program, talked to the counselors, and had that moment of, wait a second, you're getting support for your teen. Your teens were struggling. You have somewhere to send them. You have somewhere that they can go learn more about themselves and how to deal with stresses of life and new tools. And why don't we have that? And so very, very organically, the program bled outward.
And I don't know how many schools, I suppose you know, but I know there are a number of them. I think I counted 6 or 8. And then including schools with very different demographics.
Yeah, that's been incredibly important to me and to our whole team. You know, it was just how it unfolded that our program started in a school where I would say on average, most parents of the students I was working with had heard of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. It's Portland, Oregon. No surprises right there. But it was incredibly important for me to know that what we were doing could be 100% equally digestible and applicable to teens who had parents who perhaps were devout Muslim or Christian or, you know, didn't have parents who were open to Eastern philosophies and perhaps owned their own yoga studio or something. You know, it was really, really important to me. And so we've been very dedicated to ensuring that our curriculum can meet the needs of all the students that we serve.
And it's, yeah, I think that's one of the questions that people might bring up as this religion or this is really a secular approach.
Yeah, it's important to acknowledge that the tools we're offering have historically come in the packaging of specific religions. And that I think what's so critical about the time we're in now is that we're learning how to have the essence of these tools. For example, learning how to unconditionally love each other. You know, learning how to be present to each other, learning how to, we're in a time where I think it's important to learn how to allow those tools to exist outside the limitation of a religious context.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It's not, learning to love each other isn't dogma.
It's certainly not.
Or a belief system or anything like that. So what we're talking, in fact, people of all different, I think, religious practices and none, find mindfulness training to be an assistance to their lives.
Yes, I agree. And I credit Jon Kabat-Zinn for, you know, how he brought mindfulness into hospitals and other settings so that folks could see it can support anyone who wishes to be supported by it.
Now, this isn't just you. You mentioned you have a few instructors. How many are there and what kind of training do they receive?
Yeah, thank you. I have a terrific relationship with Sam Hendricks, who is our program manager. There's a man named Barnaby who I am forever grateful to have been connected to. Barnaby wears about 10 different hats in the organization, but he's really an outreach coordinator, a developer of contexts in which we can move, you know. So he's also teaching in Cleveland High School as he takes on those other hats of expanding the organization. Janice Owenby, I moved from New York City, of course, with her permission. I pleaded as we expanded the program, and she is a terrific, she's a person who's deeply dedicated to supporting the evolution of the curriculum as well as training new folks. So those are the full-time employees. And then we have part-time employees that support the organization as well. So we have a part-time communication coordinator. We have a part-time administrator. And then we have part-time teachers. And those are all teachers who've been, of course, trained by me. And I should mention that we are simultaneously creating a training program. When these teachers came on board, they came on board because they were adult students who I knew the depth of their mindfulness practice, and I knew that it wouldn't take a lot for them to learn the curriculum that we had designed and apply the depth of their experience to working with teens, which in our case, all the teachers we have had previous experience with teens.
Have you had any bites from people in different areas of the country or perhaps other parts of the Portland metro to include mindfulness in their curriculums?
Yeah, I'd say more than bites. I'd say that at least every week we get an email from someone who is interested in what we're doing. And I appreciate that because it has allowed me to see the depth of the need regarding what it is that we're offering. And in terms of our own expansion, there's little that's more important to me than keeping the integrity of what we've built. And so we're not in a hurry to expand, as much as I hate to admit that to some who are eager to have the program. What has allowed the program to be as successful as it is the depth of practice from those who are teaching the class. So, yeah, I've just learned that that's absolutely critical. So we have some folks in Seattle that are likely candidates to bring the program to Seattle next. We have some folks in California that are likely candidates, and we're moving at a very cautious pace.
I can appreciate that because I can imagine that scaling up could be quality control.
Absolutely.
would be an issue. And if I don't know if there's any kind of, you're starting it out. I mean, there isn't any kind of national curriculum or anything like that. And I imagine it could go in different directions in different places too.
Yeah. Which
might be a good thing.
Exactly. You know, what I appreciate about what's happening in this mindfulness boom is people are being creative. I mean, we're creating something new. And in the creation of something new, one of the shadow sides of that is folks who don't actually have very much experience with mindfulness are sometimes offering it as a kind of quick fix to our stresses. And that's not what we're doing in this class. This class isn't a quick fix. This isn't a self-improvement plan. This isn't a class that just merely helps students do better on their tests. Now, students do report to me that they actually feel like they do better on their tests, but we don't go in with that goal. You know, we're here to remind folks of their inherent wholeness, to help them tap in with their own sense of goodness, which we lose. We lose that experience of connection to ourselves as we struggle with the pressures of the world. And then as we experience who we authentically are, yes, we tend to be able to be more social in our lives if that was a struggle before. We tend to improve better on tests because we're no longer struggling with self-talk that says we're an idiot. You know, those things are byproducts, but they're not our goal.
You know, I want to wrap us here by going back. The principal, Brian, can we get his last name?
Yeah, Brian Jittard of Wilson High School.
He came to you saying, hey, I've got these issues. Now he's had the mindfulness program now for a couple of years. Without giving names, without giving any details, particularly how successful stories with in this regard.
Yeah, I mean, do you have a few hours? I'm so deeply moved on a regular basis by the success stories of our program. I mean, just on the statistics level, you know, 97% of teens report positive changes in their emotional and mental state after participating in our course. And, you know, 92% of our teens report less stress, less tension, and less anxiety in and outside school. So we have, and by the way, we have a wonderful gal from Johns Hopkins that's going to do her dissertation, and we're about to create an outside study. These are all just internal, you know, before pre and post statistics that we gather, but the statistics are truly off the charts regarding what these teens say about how the class affects them. But what really touches me are the actual testimonials. You know, what really touches me is when you hear a teen say, this actually just happened to me last week, a teen said, do you know that this class literally saved my life? I'm not speaking in terms of a metaphor here. I struggled so deeply with anxiety before this class that I was flunking out of school, that I was struggling with family life because I was flunking out of school. The worse I did in school, the more school I skipped, the more I got into trouble because I wasn't in school. And I mean, her life truly was spiraling downward to the point of, you know that point where your life starts to spiral and you begin to ask yourself, will I be able to pick it up from here? You know, there's kind of a, for I think some of us, a point of, it's not no return, but it's hard to imagine how a return to balance or ease could actually be possible. Well, her life really was heading in that direction. And as a person of color, she felt the weight of racism that her family had experienced, that she had experienced. And it was incredibly powerful to me that not only could she have something in her life that she feels saved her life, but that she's so articulate now. This is the joy of working with teenagers. You know, they're articulate. So mm-hmm. she's a senior in high school now. So she's able to name exactly what it was that has given her a new sense of how she can be in the world from a completely different orientation than before the class. So it's incredibly powerful, you know, and I have teens who, you know, struggle with self-harm. I have teens who've attempted suicide, you know, to watch transformation in those arenas. It just doesn't really get more powerful than that in my experience.
Kaberly Morgan has been my guest. She's the founding director of Peace in Schools. Thank you for what you do and for being with me today.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
After the break, I speak with Dinah Ramey Berry. Dr. Berry is an associate professor of history and African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved, From Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. This is The Beloved Community on KBOO. I'm John Schuck. Stay with us. My guest is Dinah Ramey Berry. She is an associate professor of historian, African and African diaspora studies, and the Oliver H. Radke Regents Fellow in History at the University of Texas at Austin. And she's an award-winning historian, also a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians. She's written a book called The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved, From Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. And she's with me via Skype from Austin, Texas. Welcome, Dr. Berry.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Tell me how this book came to be and all of the research that went into it.
Oh, my gosh. That's kind of a loaded question. But this book actually was a chapter in my first book. And I was just looking at how enslaved people were valued in one county in Georgia. And the publishers felt that the work that I had done for that particular chapter really didn't fit with the rest of the book that I wrote. And that they said, you know, we really think you have something here and maybe you should explore it further in another project. And so this book was just a chapter of another book. And then I decided to go on and look at enslaved people's prices. And one of the things that I was after at that time, and this was, you know, more than 10 years ago, but I was trying to figure out whether or not women's values, their monetary values, were higher than enslaved males' values during their childbearing years. Because I knew that the value of enslaved people and the system of slavery in the United States, particularly after the closing of the transatlantic slave trade in 1808, that particular time switch made it such that women became important because they gave birth to new laborers. And the status of enslaved people was defined by whether or not their mother was enslaved. And so I thought, let me see if this is a pattern that's a national pattern, because I did find that was the case for this one community in Georgia. And I started doing research in the archives and collecting data on enslaved people's prices. And what I discovered was that that was not the case, and that women across the board were valued at lower monetary values than male enslaved people. And I wanted to know more about this process of selling, of trading, of valuing. And I also really wanted to know what enslaved people knew and thought about being treated as a commodity.
So your book really shows the monetary values placed on the bodies of enslaved people from pre-birth to even post-death. How did you decide to put it together, and what did you discover and want to communicate in your book?
Well, I wasn't planning on looking at their values of their bodies after they died. That was something I stumbled on, and I first saw it in court records where I was looking at how enslaved people, I was looking at all the places where they were appraised, where they were given sort of a projection of their value. And when I saw these projections, I saw them in annual estate inventories. I saw them in court records where somebody passed away or somebody was suing somebody whose enslaved person died in their possession. And I wanted to know, why were they valuing them at death? You know, why did it matter that they had a monetary value? And then I realized that people were being reimbursed. And sometimes these court cases took 6 or 7 years post-mortem. And so not only were they getting the financial value of the body at the time of the appraisal that the court appraised it, of the body, then they were getting the interest on that price. And I thought, that means that their commodification extends beyond their natural lives. And I was like, I need to know more about this, because I don't think I've ever thought about it this way. I've never read anything about this, and I want to know what this means and how do I make sense of it. And so I then uncovered this postmortem, I call a domestic cadaver trade in the bodies of enslaved people, although enslaved people weren't the only ones that were being traded in that way. This was just what I was focusing on because that was the subject of my book.
You know, it was just really horrifying in reading this, that these people were was treated like livestock, really, and insurance companies and insurance and complex systems that went all through the banking system and everything to put value on people's lives as if they were livestock in a sense.
Mm-hmm. I tell my students when I teach both undergraduate and graduate students to think about the ways in which enslaved people were considered an object. They were not, you know, they were treated as objects. And when we think about that, then it doesn't necessarily make sense to us in the 21st century, but it allows us to find a way to sort of process this whole, to process the idea of that. And so when you think about that, you think about another great analogy I use is thinking about used cars or rental cars. When you go rent a car, you need to sign a contract, and you know you're liable for damages. And so enslaved people were treated the same way. They were treated like you treat a rental car. If somebody borrowed a slave or loaned their enslaved person out, and they came back and they were not in the same physical condition, they could sue. And so the court records are a really, really rich source for understanding, you know, not only the postmortem value of enslaved bodies, but also even while they were living.
You talked at one point that the way in which they would be marketed, such as prime and choice, were the same words that were used by the agriculture department.
Yes. And, you know, that I think I was telling students this, that this is an area that I think we need to do a little more research on, because when I was looking at the descriptions, I was trying to understand when enslaved people are on a 4-point scale that they're rated, right? And, you know, a full hand or an A1 prime is someone that is at the peak of their physical condition, typically between the ages of 18 and 30 years old, both male and female, and that they could do the most amount of work during the given day. That's someone that was prime. And then all other enslaved people were rated on a scale that went below that. So if you weren't a full hand, you'd be a 3/4 hand, then a half hand, then a quarter hand, and then you would have no rating at all. And so their values, their monetary values, were directly linked to this rating scale. But not all enslavers had rates in their records. So, we can't go to every plantation record and find out what an enslaved person's rate was. But those that have these records, I found a correlation that was directly related to their values.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dinah Ramey Berry. She's the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. You mentioned the transatlantic slave trade ending in 1808. What were the changes that occurred because of this transatlantic slave trade ending?
Well, first of all, the transatlantic slave trade was the supply source of slavery, right? That's where you can purchase additional laborers. When the supply source is cut off, they have to find other ways. Now, two things. One, although it was officially outlawed in the United States in 1808, illegal ships came regularly through the eve of the Civil War, literally. I think the last ship that we have record of came in 1861. Right on the eve in the early part of the Civil War. There still are Africans being brought into the United States even after 1808, illegally, all right? Now, so one of the changes that happens is that you need more laborers, and we know that women giving birth brings more laborers, and those laborers don't cost money if you own that enslaved female. So natural reproduction is a term that some historians use. Forced breeding is another term. Rape is another term. But or encouraged reproduction, if you want to be a little more euphemistic about it. Yeah. But women were key and essential to helping, quote unquote, grow the institution. I'm not saying that they did that willingly, but it's something that we find even in the literature in terms of literature between advice among masters. There's a book about that. Even in the newspapers, they'll have columns where they'll talk about how to grow a Negro. Literally, that's the term, on raising Negroes and livestock. And they literally manage this system of reproduction very similar to animal husbandry. And they thought about how they could create certain comforts for the woman. The cabin needs to be a certain way, decrease her work life, decrease her rating so that she doesn't have to do the same amount of output during a particular day, or allow her to have some respite from labor a certain amount of weeks before birth. Now, that sounds great, right? And it sounds, it sounds reasonable. But when we look at the literature and we look at the enslaved people's voices and we look at their stories, a lot of the narratives that we have will say, I didn't get enough rest. I worked up until birth, or I worked and only had a total of 3 or 6 weeks off, whether that was before or after birth. Some of them said 3 weeks is not enough time, or this is why we have like high infant mortality rates during slavery. The children didn't make it to age 5 because there was poor nutrition and they were being overworked. So although we find this advice in some of the literature, some of the lived experience differs from that advice that we're seeing in that literature. And I always tell people when I teach about the history of slavery that it's a very diverse institution and there's a large spectrum of people's experiences. There's not one sort of monolithic story. So one woman might have had great comforts when she got pregnant. She might have been given 6 months off. Another woman might have literally delivered in the field, handed the baby over, and kept working. It just varied based on the attitude of the owner and the nature of their plantation system or farm that they lived on.
And that would be different in terms of families of the enslaved, because at one part in your book, you talk about the men kind of being sold or rented out as breeders. I mean, so you had and women. So there would be different fathers and mothers for the children. So there really wasn't a family in many cases, or it was obviously forced.
Well, that's a good statement, because we do know, and there's a long literature on enslaved families, and scholars have been writing about enslaved people's families since the 1950s and 1960s. So you do have, and that's what's unique about American slavery, is that you do have the development of families. There's a quote that I always share from an enslaver who said, any Negro with a well-stocked poultry house, with a canoe, his own cabin, and a wife and a garden plot of his own will never run away. And so there's this thought of like, well, if we give them certain things and allow them to have these relationships, then maybe that will encourage them to have families. Then there's also those other individuals, like you just mentioned, who were just used as breeders, where they were literally taken around. Some of the men were taken to other plantations. If they were, and women that were fertile, they would say that they're using them as breeding women. And the term breeding changes depending on what time period you're looking at, because in the late colonial era, you know, after around the American Revolutionary generation, you know, breeding meant raising children. It didn't mean breeding like we think about it today in terms of animal breeding. But when we got into the 19th century, I saw a shift in the literature and the way newspapers and other sources were talking about how to increase your enslaved population. So some women were having birth multiple times, 13, 14 pregnancies. Some of the children would survive and some of them didn't. And when we have testimony of women that were being interviewed in the auction block, and they'd say, well, you know, how many babies can you have, or how many children can you give birth to? And some of them would say, I don't know how many I've had. I don't count them anymore. It doesn't matter. You know, I never get them, you know? So there's some that develop this emotional distance or detachment from the offspring that they bore, because they, one, didn't want them to either experience slavery. Two, they knew they would be taken away. Three, some of them died because of the high rates of infant mortality.
Well, you mentioned the auction block. Describe that a little bit. Children would be sold, ripped away from their mothers, even as babies, as soon as they were weaned. What did children and parents experience through this as you researched it?
I'm not a psychologist or anything, but I would say extreme trauma was what they experienced. And trauma that probably lasted for the rest of their lives, because we see testimony and narratives and stories after stories where they talk about how they remember that moment when they were first separated from their biological parents, because they all had multiple parents that served as in parental roles after they were separated. And women and children were separated not necessarily after they were weaned. We have evidence of babies being taken from the breast, literally, at the auction. And to be honest, I have to confess, I couldn't talk about that part of this history for about 6 years. Because I had a young child, and I nursed that child, and I could not publicly speak about it. I could not write the first three chapters of this book until my child was older. I started this book when my son was born, and he's now 11 years old. But I had a difficult time writing about the separation of very young children from their mothers. So the auction was a traumatic space, and it's also a varied space. There's the public auctions, where they're sold on courthouse steps or on a wooden stump that's, you know, from a tree stump. There are very, very public auctions. There's sheriff sales. There were private auctions or private transactions or private sales. So there's a number of different ways. Most of the auctions that I write about in this book are the more public auctions, because those are the testimonies that the evidence is still extant, where people had witnessed them and they wrote about it. And that's just, you know, part of the historian's craft. We work with what documents are still there. And so a lot of the records that I used were from these types of auction experiences. But I also found newspaper accounts where someone was describing an auction they witnessed. And sometimes in those accounts, there were quotes from enslaved people. And that's where I got the information of the enslaved person's voice. But they were inspected. Sometimes they were kept in a holding pen, a facility that looked just like a contemporary jail today, or a small county jail. Sometimes they would allow people to come and inspect the quote-unquote merchandise for sale a few days in advance of the auction. As they were being prepared for the auction, they were fed well. They would often grease their skin to make them look shiny and try to hide scars, and the skin looking shiny would make them look younger or healthier than they may have actually been. Their body cavities were searched, men and women. You know, they sometimes, as I said before, women were allowed to go behind a curtain so they could do a gynecological exam on them. And sometimes they didn't have curtains. And sometimes they just were sort of patting people down. They'd have them run in place, run up and down, jump up and down, make sure their limbs were working. And sometimes they had warranties to guarantee that this person that they're purchasing is healthy. And that's another record that we find evidence of enslaved people's sales.
I'm speaking with Dinah Ramey Berry. She's the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. And throughout your book, you trace it from infants then to adolescence to middle age and to older age and finally post-mortem. And when you moved to the adolescent part, there was also something else that developed, and you call it a soul value. While the enslaved had monetary values placed on their bodies by the enslavers, the enslaved themselves developed this soul value. Let's spend some time with that. How did you come up with that term, and what does that mean?
So I was thinking about how, by reading their words and spending time really looking for their testimonies, I was trying to understand and make sense of the will to survive, if there was one, and how they coped with being treated as a product, you know, and I wanted to know, what does it mean? We know, and there's been some really good work by sociologists and historians and psychologists that write, frankly, about how enslaved people really struggled, and they were sort of in a melancholy state and depressed and not necessarily present. Like, people talked about them as like the walking dead. They talked about them as being socially dead, as being, you know, just sort of gone. They were moving in body, but not there in spirit. And I kept thinking of, I was running into story after story or testimony after testimony of enslaved people saying, you know, it didn't matter what they did to my body. They could never take my soul. They could not touch my soul. They could not sell my soul. They could not take my immortal part. So there was something there that I saw and kept coming across, and it's in narratives, it's that sort of flickering spirit inside of them, whether they were religious or not, that they held on to survive. And it's an internal space that I describe it. I said it's not something that's tangible. I can't show you what it looks like, but it's something that I felt was communicated very loudly to me through the sources that I read. And I call it their soul value. It's the non-monetary value of their immortal selves, of their souls. So that, you know, you have an enslaved man named Mingo who's ran away after he was separated from his wife and his kids. And he was also a poet, and he would write poems. And he wrote a poem on the beam of a prison wall and to his wife. And it was the night before he passed away, before he was captured and killed. He didn't know when he was writing this poem that it was the night before he was going to die. But he said, you know, all these beautiful things, a beautiful poem. And he says at the end, though, he says that, you know, no matter what happens, basically, they cannot sell that immortal part. And he talked about, you know, thinking about seeing her somewhere else. So they believed that some of them believed that there was a separation at death between the body and the soul, and that the soul would live on no matter what happens to the body. And they needed to live and believe and think that. And I wonder to myself, like, you know, what happens if they knew about some of the things that happened to their physical body, you know, after they died, the commodification of their bodies afterwards. But I think for them, there's a release of the soul. And this soul value is something that I found kept people going. And I would argue allowed, you know, nearly 4 million people to walk away from slavery in 1865 when they were given their freedom with the 13th Amendment.
That poem you included in your book, would you read that?
I'd be happy to. Good God, and I must leave them now, my wife, my children, in their woe? 'Tis mockery to say I'm sold, but I forget these chains so cold. Dear wife, they cannot sell the rose of love that in my bosom glows. Remember, as your tears may start, they cannot sell thy immortal part. Thou sun which lighteth bond and free, tell me, I pray, is liberty the lot of those who noblest feel and oft to Jehovah's kneel? I feel high manhood on me now, a spirit glory on my brow. I feel a thrill of music roll like angel harpenings through my soul.
Dinah Raimi Berry reading from her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved, From Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation, a poem there about a man, Mingo, writing about his soul value, as you put it. I wanted to go further. One of the questions that you ask throughout the book is how, and I don't think you ever answer because you don't really know, you can't get into it, but how they felt about being valued. What did it mean to say for a 19-year-old to be sold for $1,000?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, people ask me that all the time. And when the closest I can get to understanding that is that I don't think that they actually cared so much about the monetary value, like they took pride in it. Like a lot of people ask me, did they have bragging rights? From what I can tell, and I mean, there may be other records that I haven't seen, but from what I can tell, they didn't care about their value, their monetary value, their auction value, their appraised value, only so much that it mattered in terms of who they were being sold to or who they did not want to be sold to. So sometimes on the auction, they would interrupt the sale and say, well, I'm not that valuable, or I am that valuable. I'm stronger than that. And they would try to up their price or lower their price not because they wanted to feel a sense of pride in how much they were worth, but it was typically because their mother was sold, or their sister or their aunt or their brother or their spouse, their partner, had been sold to that particular person, or they had been sold to another state and they knew that this person these people that were auctioning on them were from the Deep South or what have you. And so sometimes you see that manipulation coming. But when I look at other testimonies about enslaved people and they talk about values, they say, you know, they talk about first-rate enslaved people. There's a gentleman in the book I write about, and he says, I'll tell you what first-rate is. They talk about first-rate. What first-rate is for me, and this is him writing after he's freed, after he freed himself, self-liberated, and made it to Canada. He says, you know, first-rate for me is being able to make it here, to have my own garden plot, to be able to have whatever I plant is mine, and to live here with my family in freedom. That's what I call first rate.
And that's soul value right there, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The subtitle of your book is Building the Nation. Can you talk about how America has been built on the price of human flesh?
Yeah. Literally and figuratively. I mean, I think that's would be my first response to that. One, enslaved people have worked through not only universities, which is a new area of scholarship, but they built the canals. They helped build the railroads for this country. They helped build the cities when the American colonies were founded, when enslaved people were brought here. They helped the infrastructure of a vast area of this country. And that those contributions continued well into the 19th century. And one of the pieces that I'm arguing here is that the black bodies that were once enslaved and also free helped build our understanding of the human body and of American medicine. And that's the other piece that I have here as well, besides the physical building of houses and infrastructures and towns and cities. They also help build our understanding of human anatomy.
Because they would sell the bodies to medical schools.
Yes. And the medical schools would use the cadavers to train students on understanding different aspects of the human body, whether they had been healthy bodies or not. Because they still, you know, benefited from medical anomalies when bodies were diseased. There were advertisements in newspapers saying, you know, if you have six slaves that have, you know, these particular ailments, we'll buy them from you. We want to study them. So they were very much a part. Harriet Washington and medical apartheid writes about this. And so does Todd Savitt in Medicine and Slavery. And a number of other scholars are working on this research. Stephen Kinney out of Liverpool is coming out with a book, I think, pretty soon on the same topic.
My guest has been Dinah Raimi Berry. She's the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved, From Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. Dinah Raimi Berry, professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Thank you so much for this book, this insight, and for being with me today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Beloved Community, Resources for Activism. Catch The Beloved Community on the second Friday of every month at 9 a.m. on KBOO. You can hear the podcast of this show on the website, kboo.fm/beloved community. More information on my website, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schock. Be well.